The headlines. Alexan Smilov becomes Kazakhstan's new prime minister, following days of violent unrest that led to the dismissal of the cabinet. Fresh attacks target two American military convoys in Iraq, amid growing anger at the presence of U.S. forces there. More than 1.35 million new COVID cases in the U.S. That is the highest daily total for any country in the world. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Kazakhstan has been in the headlines for the past week over protests against fuel price hikes that led to the resignation of the cabinet. Now the country has a new prime minister. Just a short while ago, parliament voted to appoint Alexan Smilov as the new premier. President Kasym Tokayev has appointed him to form a new cabinet. He served as deputy prime minister in the previous government that resigned last week when the unrest erupted. The protests were peaceful in the beginning, but they later became deadly and violent. Nearly 10,000 people are now in detention. The Interior Ministry says rioters attacked government buildings in several major cities. The president blames foreign militants mainly from Central Asia, Afghanistan, and West Asia for the chaos, calling it a coup attempt. Russia deployed its troops to help restore peace, but Tokayev says that foreign troops will be leaving in 2 days. Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist and political commentator. He believes the West has likely initiated the unrest in Kazakhstan to pressure Russia over the Ukraine issue. Let's take a listen.
First of all, Kazakhstan has always been a specific arena of interests for Western policy. So it was a question of time when it was going to happen. So now we witness it happened. So I have no doubts that it has been a coup, an attempt to overthrow a government of Tokayev. So maybe by some forces inside Kazakhstan and with big help of forces, you know, from you know where, I suspect, that from the United States and the other NATO countries, how it happened in the Ukraine. So it's lines up. NATO presses Russia, comes closer, and Kazakhstan would be a perfect arena for them to get into and to take over.
The sustained campaign by pro-Palestine activists has finally paid off, with an Israeli-owned arms firm selling off one of its controversial factories in England. Activists have been holding weekly protests for 18 months at the site of the Elbit factory in Oldham, Greater Manchester. They've closed the entrance to the site several times in protest at its role in war and occupation. Pro-Palestine campaigners are seeing the closure as a big victory. They're outraged at Elbit for supplying the Israeli military with equipment that is used to attack the besieged Palestinian population in the Gaza Strip. Palestine Action, one of the key campaigning groups, says repeated closures of the factory have cost the company millions. Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest arms companies, which produces weapons, parts, and surveillance equipment. U.S. military convoys in Iraq have been targeted again amid a recent surge in similar attacks. According to Iraqi media reports, a convoy was struck with an improvised explosive device in Al-Muthanna Governorate early on Tuesday. The blast has not caused any damage. Separately, a U.S. convoy has been targeted in Baghdad. So far, we have no additional details about that attack. Anti-U.S. sentiment has been growing in Iraq over its military and political interventions in the region. Last week, several drone and rocket strikes were carried out against different U.S. bases. The Yemeni army says its forces have downed a spy drone over the southern province of Shabwa. According to the army spokesman, the armed drone was hit with a surface-to-air missile on Tuesday morning. Yahya Sari says the drone was a winged Lung unmanned aircraft operated by the United Arab Emirates. The UAE claims it has ended most of its combat operations in Yemen. Last month, the Yemeni armed forces said that they had downed over 100 hostile drones in the country's airspace in the year 2020. The forces and allied popular committees are fighting a Saudi-led aggression that has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and displaced millions of others since 2015. UN experts are urging the U.S. to shut down its notorious Guantanamo Bay prison, calling it an ugly chapter of unrelenting human rights violations. More than a dozen human rights experts have voiced outrage at the detention camp still operating in Cuba. They say that 20 years of arbitrary detention without trial, accompanied by torture of inmates, is simply unacceptable for any government, especially the one that claims to be the defender of human rights. UN experts describe the facility as a site of unparalleled notoriety and a stain on Washington's stated commitment to the rule of law. They have urged the U.S. to close the site, return detainees home, or to save third countries, and provide remedy and reparation for those tortured and detained arbitrarily. The notorious prison was established in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. Moving on to the United States, where the pandemic is entering uncharted territory. The country is witnessing a dramatic surge, reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The extremely contagious Omicron variant is largely to blame for the rise. The strain has already pushed medical centers to the brink. The number of hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 COVID patients have been admitted to hospitals nationwide. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The U.S. says it needs $5 billion in aid to stop Afghanistan from sinking into a humanitarian crisis this year. That is the organization's biggest ever appeal for a single country.
This is a stopgap, an absolutely essential stopgap measure that we are putting in front of the international community today. Without this being funded, there won't be a future. We need this to be done. Otherwise, there will be outflow, there will be suffering.
Griffiths is warning that the absence of humanitarian aid could lead to more deaths, hunger, and further mass displacement. He says the funding would help the Afghan economy and facilitate humanitarian agencies' operations there. A lack of funding is battering Afghanistan's already troubled economy. The country is on the edge of a full-blown crisis, with Washington freezing billions of dollars of its assets since the Taliban takeover in mid-August. As a result, aid supplies have been disrupted, leading to rising poverty and hunger. John Stepling, writer and political commentator, joins us from Inderøy, Norway. We also have James Tweedy, who's a journalist and commentator, joining us from Plymouth in the UK. Welcome to you both. John Stepling, let me first start with you. We know there's a humanitarian crisis unfolding of mammoth proportions there. We could talk about that, but I'm curious, on the other hand, that given the state of affairs in Afghanistan and the instability that's risen because of this humanitarian situation, who would benefit from instability in Afghanistan?
Well, the United States 40 years ago launched Operation Cyclone to arm the Mujahideen and draw the Soviets into their own Vietnam, as Brzezinski said. Over a million Afghans have died since then. I mean, it's been four decades of interference and of course, 20 years of occupation that just recently ended. The U.S. could solve this tomorrow, of course, the humanitarian crisis, the starvation and so forth, but they're very keen to keep China, whose presence has grown in Afghanistan, to keep China from filling the void of the U.S. leaving. But you have to remember that Biden was one of the chief architects under Obama in training the anti-Taliban death squads, Afghan death squads, named Zero One, with CIA support that attacked madrasas, children were killed, and so forth. The Afghans, the Taliban, haven't forgotten that. It got worse under Trump with Pompeo, who was, an extremist and fanatic, really. The U.S. hasn't stopped bombing. There are private security contractors still in Afghanistan. The drone warfare continues. Biden admits this. So it's It is part of a, I mean, this is what the U.S. and CIA have done globally and certainly in that region and in particular Afghanistan for a very long time. And who's going to benefit? DynCorp and Lockheed Martin and these people always benefit. But the U.S. Can't afford boots on the ground right now. And while they're also having open meetings, the State Department and Pentagon itself with Taliban leadership. This is the pattern. It seems contradictory, but it breeds a kind of chaos that actually benefits the United States and it long term. And this has gone on for so long that I feel like I'm telling this old story, because it's not going to change. And they try to put a window dressing on this crisis by saying they are insisting on women's rights in the region and so forth, and it's just nonsense. I mean, everybody knows it's nonsense, and it's tiresome in a sense to keep repeating it. The U.S. is not in the business of building democracy or autonomy for anybody. They wanted a client state in 2001 when they invaded and started the occupation. They wanted to establish a client state in a geographically strategic region next door to China, Iran, and so forth. And they don't want any of those original goals to change.
Sure. Well, you mentioned some of the neighbors there. And James Sweetie, my question to you is kind of along the same lines as my question to John Stepling. You have a country that obviously needs the humanitarian aid. Of course, you have funds that are locked up. That's one side of the story. But, when you have this breeding ground that's perfect and ripe for terrorism to arise from it and for recruitments to take place, it leads to instability in that country. And you have neighbors like Iran and then you have China. Is there ulterior motives here for this instability to remain and for these terrorists to go ahead with their operations?
Okay, well, I mean, the Kazakh government says that some of the insurgents who took part in the attempted coup there came from Afghanistan, and some people have said that the franchise of Daesh in Afghanistan is actually made of people that is recruited from Syria by the U.S. and transported there. I don't know if you can prove that. There's something. I mean, the obvious thing to me, though, is that the UN is asking for $4.4 billion in aid for Afghanistan for what they say is a humanitarian crisis, but I don't know if there is one. And at the same time, there's $9.5 billion of money that belongs to the Afghan Central Bank, which is deposited in accounts in the USA, which is frozen, which the USA has frozen, isn't refusing to give to the Afghan government. And the question is, why did the previous government of Afghanistan deposit its money in the banks of a country which invaded and occupied their country? And obviously the point is, the reason is, to allow the US to do that and to keep Afghanistan dependent on the US. And the thing is that aid and charity also makes the recipient dependent, and one has to therefore assume that is that's the true motive of it. You see, this money is not going to be spent. It's going to be spent on. It's not money that will be given to the government to spend. It will be money that the UN pays to companies, probably in the West, to provide materials. Pays to its own staff to go to Afghanistan and give those out and supplant the role of the government. And so they would take over governing the country. And you see that the UN in recent times has worryingly attempted to supplant the government in places like Libya, where the government was destroyed, the state was destroyed. South Sudan, which is a country that the US created and immediately became a failed state. Somalia, which the US has destabilized. Yemen, which Saudi Arabia has invaded, and so on. And Saudi Arabia was supported by the US and other Western countries. So in all of these Western destabilizations and destructions of countries, then the UN moves in and tries to take over the government, essentially the government of the country. So what Afghanistan needs, it needs that money back that the US has stolen from it. And Afghanistan needs to buy an air defense system so it can shoot down these drones that the US is sending to attack the country. That's what it needs. That's going to prevent people from being displaced because their villages have been bombed by the US, isn't it? It's going to prevent destabilization. I mean, Afghanistan probably needs to buy some arms to counter what is left of Daesh, Khorasan province, and so on. So the UN is not going to provide any of this, is it, with its aid? What the UN is going to do is come in, is going to take over the food distribution system and supplant the commercial retail of food. It's going to probably take over the health provision and supplant the national health system as it is, or the local health system as it is provided. And it's going to probably take over the education system, and it's going to be teaching, it's going to be setting an education curriculum which is not in the control of the legitimate government.
Okay.
You know, as it does in other, as aid agencies and charities do in other countries. So, no, this is not for Afghanistan's benefit. And the blackmail of saying, oh, we don't get this money, we're not allowed to go into Afghanistan and take over the country,
right,
the running of the country. There's going to be mass migration, and they're going to be washing up on your shores dead in dinghies or something. Okay, that's just emotional blackmail to well-meaning people in the West.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much for that. James Sweeney, journalist and commentator, and John Stepling, thank you for your input, writer and political commentator from Norway. With that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.com. www.tehwantv.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
On the 3rd of January 2020, Iran's most powerful military commander, General Qasem Soleimani, was killed by a U.S. military airstrike in Iraq.
The 62-year-old general was the key military leader in the Middle East and led operations as head of Iran's elite Quds force. The general was widely regarded as a heroic national figure, in part because he was instrumental in the destruction of the ISIL terrorist organization after the failure of the West to achieve this outcome. The general was killed at Baghdad airport, along with other Iran-backed militia figures, in a strike ordered by US President Donald Trump. 2 years later, the assassination remains unexplained and almost forgotten by the Western media. Yet his killing provoked a wave of mourning and rage against the assassinating country, America. Indeed, to the public in Iran and to many abroad, part of the impact was to serve as yet another example of Western military policy carried out to the illegal killing of a senior member of another country's military force.
How many people in Britain are aware of General Soleimani's essential role in fighting ISIL? And how would people here feel if such a key player in this country were assassinated by a foreign power? Simple questions with important answers. And let's begin by establishing the extent of public awareness of the general, his work, and his assassination. We asked the public in London if they'd heard of Qasem Soleimani, and if not, whether they could guess his country of origin. Here's what they said. There's a person called Qasem Soleimani. Have you heard of him, or do you think maybe you've heard of him? Can you guess what he does, or maybe where he came from, even if it's a guess?
Iran, maybe. He's from Iran, and he's a general. And that's what I heard.
General Soleimani was primarily responsible for destroying the terrorist organization ISIL after the West proved unable to do so. Is the public aware of this? And what do they think of the fact this achievement was carried out by an Iranian general? What do you think of that achievement? And were you aware of the fact an Iranian general basically was responsible for killing ISIL?
No, not at all. I thought it was probably a combination of the Iraqis and the Americans.
Did you know that achievement? What do you think about it?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that. I think that's great.
Are you surprised that it was actually an Iranian general who basically led this? And what do you think of that achievement?
I'm not surprised in the slightest. I think that generally people who are local and have the knowledge and power and vested interest and know their communities and know the people are going to be the people best suited and best able because they're going to have the support of local people because they're from there and they want to do it.
Have you seen anything in the media about him?
No. The only reason why I think I know this is, was he targeted? And he was killed by a drone attack, is that right? Yeah, okay, so I think I do know him. It was the Americans. Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, I know who we're talking about now.
No, I didn't know it, but obviously it is quite an achievement. ISIL was quite a terrifying organisation. Yeah. So, well done him, but...
Now that you've mentioned the guy does ring a bell.
There's not a huge amount in the media. You get sort of some news stories and obviously some things filter through, but it's just the stories don't necessarily there and names don't always ring bells. So I think unless you're really trying to keep up to date with everything, it's very easy to miss us. There's an awful lot that goes on in the world.
I don't know what surprised me anymore. So I'm surprised that you don't hear about it on the media, I guess. But also, I don't know, on the media you hear random stuff, so...
I guess it's surprising, but also it's not.
I'm actually quite surprised to hear this, I'm not going to lie, especially because we haven't heard anything about this in the media, I mean, especially not in London. So, yeah, actually, very surprised.
General Soleimani has not been widely recognised for his work in destroying ISIL. But what would have been the reaction if a British or an American general, instead of an Iranian one, had brought down that terrorist movement?
I'm surprised. I don't know either. I'm not huge on history. I don't know a lot, but I'm surprised.
If a British or an American general had been responsible for destroying ISIL, how much coverage do you think that would have got? How much of a hero would that person have been instead of being an Iranian general?
He would probably have a huge statue built up somewhere here, maybe in central London. Being in London, that would be a huge deal for the British people. I wish there was more recognition.
I'm sure there would have been a lot of press publicity about it. There was when they took down Saddam Hussein. Yeah, so I would imagine it would have been somewhat similar.
There would have been a lot more publicity around it. They would have made a lot more out of that fact that he was British or American. Yeah.
Why was the same not happening for the Iranian general?
I don't know, but maybe the media outlets are very, very biased and have a very, very narrow view on what they want to show and what people are interested in.
Britain seems to just be very inward-looking these days. I don't know. And then, of course, I think the media also report what they think people will be interested in, I guess. There's a lot of interesting things happening that we never get to hear of, you know.
I think I'd have heard an awful lot more about it if it had been a British or an American general who'd done that. You'd have had it all over the news. We probably would have had someone with knighthood honours by now. And, just would have had a lot more generally in the general consciousness.
Would the reaction be different for a British or American general versus an Iranian one?
I think so, yeah. Why? There's such a divide of us versus them. I think it would be natural for us to find pride in it's us that have fought the bad guys and won.
The noise that comes out of how war gets narrated, I suppose. I'm very distrustful of anything with a British badge on it anyway, I guess, just from coming from Northern Ireland. So I probably wouldn't have tuned into it no matter what it was. And our papers are full of scandalous things about celebrities and Brexit-related stuff. You know, a lot of it extremely tedious.
I think media just show us what they want us to see, and I think that explains completely why we haven't heard about this. And it would have been completely different for sure. I would have been able to know who did this, and you know, to talk a bit more about it.
Yeah, I suppose it's like I'm just really surprised that today is the first day that I've really heard about it. That seems absurd given kind of, how big the event was and how, if it was the other way around, we definitely would have heard about it. So I feel a bit ignorant that there's really been no coverage here, or at least not what I've seen.
Yeah, I think it would have been probably quite big in the media. People would have known and heard of him.
Oh, definitely. I think the media is always Western-leaning, isn't it? So, and it's easier to prop up someone who is a face that we all recognise and can get behind. That's been the case for years, where I think if the viewers don't see themselves in it, they don't relate, and therefore it's not TV-worthy.
General Soleimani, who was Iranian, he's not really been recognised in the West at all, as far as I can see, for destroying ISIL. What would have been the reaction if a British or an American general had demonstrably destroyed ISIL?
Well, they would have been feted, so knighted of some sort and some sort of medal, so... Yeah, I thought he was. Didn't the Americans assassinate him via a drone? Yeah, so I have heard of him. Yeah.
Let's look at the legal issues. Washington ratified the Charter of the United Nations and is therefore bound by it. Agnes Callamard, UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions, stated the Soleimani assassination could only be justified in response to an imminent threat. She believes Washington has provided no such evidence, concluding the course of action taken by the US was unlawful, adding even at the most basic level, the US did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary. Calamard also warned it was the first targeted drone killing of a senior foreign government official on the territory of a third country, and that the world now faces the very real prospect that states may opt to strategically eliminate high-ranking military officials outside the context of a known war. The fact that by 2028, the USA aims to have 1,000 unmanned combat drones makes it the prime candidate for carrying out further such assassinations.
General Soleimani was assassinated by American operatives on the orders of then-American President Donald Trump. Does the public know this, and what do they think of the fact this killing was sponsored by a U.S. president?
I think it's completely sick. I mean Donald Trump, I mean, he's completely crazy to me, to be honest, but to know that it's an assassination and the man is just walking free and no one has heard of it is even more insane, to be honest. Yeah, feel sick a little bit.
I've heard of a drone strike and Donald Trump, I'm not surprised. what do I think of it? I mean, it's probably not the last drone strike that we will hear of, so I hope that we will have a right framework to deal with those things in the future.
I may be feeling cynical, but I'm not surprised, I guess. Like, I don't, and I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson did the same thing. I think we're a little better than America on that front, for sure. And I grew up around people who don't behave that way and have similar surnames and all those things, but my brain still thinks that way because of the media that were around. So it's easier for Donald Trump to just come on live TV and celebrate something that is illegal because he knows that everyone else will be like, well, that probably tracks, because of the way we're kind of geared to see those things. So, like, just hearing the surname Soleimani, like, my surname is Hussein. Like, I grew up with getting teased for that, and it's like, you just, your automatic assumptions when you ask a question like that is a bit unfortunate. So
outrageous, and basically, like all war crimes, you should really have it brought to justice. It shouldn't be acceptable for someone from one nation to go off and kill someone else because of whatever beliefs they have. So
I'm not surprised. You know, I got no time for Donald Trump, and I can't understand the support that he has, or that he has had, I suppose. But it's not like it's the first time that sort of shenanigans has gone on, I guess.
It does feel like it was a murder, and I, the fact that Trump carried it out is probably confirms in my mind that it was not a good thing.
There's a complete misalignment there with the kind of what happened. I mean, Donald Trump, I suppose, was unique, you hope, so I'm not sure how reflective that is of kind of American politics generally, but yeah, that does seem like there is something unfinished there that needs to perhaps be looked into, I guess.
If a British or an American general were assassinated on the orders of a foreign power, what would be the reaction? And to what extent does the public feel this is a classic case of double standards?
I'm sure it's been attempted, but I think if it was, there'd be a reaction from the West that the Middle East has never seen. So behind the scenes, covertly and overtly. So, which I think is the reason that the balance of law is maintained. But yeah, you're right, there's a degree of double standards, but at the same time, it's state-sponsored terrorism, isn't it? So he has been in the past implicated and proven that he's taken part in numerous attacks against the West or interests of the West.
Yeah, there would be total uproar, I think, if it happened here, because people don't believe in that sort of thing generally, do they?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure there are double standards in the world all over the place. And yeah, the reaction would have been different. If it had been the head of the British forces, it would have been all over our news. Was it all over the Iranian news? Then that's what you would expect, for it to be more publicised in the relevant country. But yeah, we would have heard about it, and so would the rest of the world if it had been one of ours.
And if the head of the British Army was assassinated by anyone, not least from the Middle East, that there would be, it wouldn't be very good. I think it would be a pretty sight, probably lead to war. Yeah.
Britain's built on double standards. You know, the whole, that's what the empire is all about. You know what I mean? It's about power and control. So, of course, people would be outraged, you know. But, you don't have to go very far to see that double standard play out again and again and again. So, again, it's not surprising.
As we said, I don't know enough about it, so I'm now intrigued and interested to go and find out more. And I think part of the difficulty is that we're so often not given the facts, and that news is sold as fact, where it's not. And I think particularly in the last couple of years we've been inundated with data and statistics, and we're either left to process them ourselves or we're relying on someone to interpret them for us. And I think often we're sold information through news and media that's fact when it's not. And so you have to question everything behind it. And I think if someone had been, who was British, had been shot, then it would have been seen as a murder and everything. I just think I look at the word refugee and migrant, and that's what we call people who come to this country. And yet when you go abroad, a British person is called an expatriate. There's something charming about it. There's so many double standards about how we perceive where people are from and what right they have to access resources and that nationality and that country. And why were we even in Iran and Iraq in the first place? What was in it for Britain? And I think we were probably missold. Were we there in the first place?
I certainly don't think that government should be involved in assassinating people in general. I don't think that's their role. I don't know what Iran's reaction is to this event. So, for me, I wouldn't be able to say whether it's double standards, because I don't know, how they're perceiving it, how they're reacting to it.
I don't know if I could call it double standards, but we tend to publicly say things that are basically what the people want to hear and what the government wants to portray at the time.
The double standards, yes, but that would be a double standard.
Why did we get away with it?
Because we're in a stronger position.
Yes, there are double standards, and that's simply because the lives in the Middle East are worth less than the lives in the West, because that's the way we're all grown up to think. Like, that's just how it works. Like, it's always been the case. Like, the British Empire believes that they are going around and healing the earth because they think that their lives are better than the others, and that's been the case for hundreds of years. And I feel like sometimes it's better to let a country learn its own lessons and be its own culture, and that means some countries have things that we would see as distasteful or not quite what we want, but that's not necessarily meaning we need to go in and interrupt. So I didn't really quite answer the direct question that you asked, but none of that stuff surprises me. It's a symptom of Western culture for the last hundreds of years, basically.
I think if that had happened, we'd be at war right now. We all know the reaction to 9/11. It was pretty unequivocal that we went straight into the Middle East. And I think if a drone strike went and killed a head of state in a UK or an American country, something similar would happen again. So, yeah, we're absolutely guilty of double standards.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I feel like wherever you go, you'll find double standards. If a scenario like this would repeat itself with other people in the spotlight, the response in the media would be very different.
If a British general or an American general was assassinated because of a head of state in the Middle East saying so, what do you think would happen? Would we go into war? I mean, do you think they're a double standard?
Yeah, definitely, I do. Particularly thinking about it now, being asked, I think that there would be outcry. Yeah, there'd be uproar if it was the other way around.
Are we guilty of double standards towards the Middle East?
Oh my God, completely. The double standards are really, really obvious in that case, specifically, I think, because I think the public opinion would have been completely crazy. And yeah, I think there would have been really, really heavy repercussion. The media would have used that story again and again and again. And here we are. We haven't heard of it.
I'm sure it would be headlines, terrorist attack, Iranian person killed huge leader in the UK. They would probably use that as a justification to start another, not a war, but some kind of conflict. And I studied human geography, so we did a lot of politics, geopolitics, and it's crazy how countries just hide behind these excuses of, oh, they did this, so therefore we have to do this to counter it. But
just
General Qasem Soleimani was killed by America, but mourned by Iran and many others. Yet few in the West have any real idea about the huge contribution the general made in putting right what the West did wrong, especially in relation to ISIL. Worse still, few doubt the strength of reaction if a Western figure of General Soleimani's stature were assassinated on the orders of another nation's head of state.
It's clear that Washington has been unable to justify the killing of a man who saved the Middle East and the world from ISIL, a terror group largely created by Western military miscalculations. Though the Western public is not encouraged to know the truth, many insist these facts are shared. Yet if such an attack were carried out against a Western power, it could lead to invasion or even war. For many, this death by double standards continues to stain the reputation of the West, because the years since the murder of General Soleimani do not diminish the crime.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. Human rights in general from his perspective. One of the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi had to face was poverty of his time. And obviously, not just his time, but he wanted to pass the message to generations to come until the Day of Judgment. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he looked at the world intently. He looked at every aspect of it, without any exception, of course. He kept the individuals as well as the collective rights of the people in mind and did not ignore anything, which is quite a rigorous task to do, that when you want to solve a problem as big as poverty, you need to look at every possible way to eradicate such a problem, keeping, of course, the rights of individuals and people in mind. A task that many organizations today, with billions of dollars behind their backs and government behind their backs, are trying to eradicate poverty, and they are failing miserably. Why? Because they are looking at things with one eye, from one scope. They're not taking every possible opportunities, and even if they manage to find a way, they will end up stepping on other people's right. So in order for me to, do something for humanity, for example, I'm trying to cure a disease, what these people do, this organization, they go to Africa and they test their vaccines on human beings. They turn them into lab rats, which means they put their lives in danger. Now, this is exactly Amir al-Mu'mineen did not do. He looked at every possible way, keeping in mind that no one should be hurt in the process. He invited the people to look at the beauty of the world and the wonders of creation. At the same time, informed the individuals as well as the society of their rights, so they might acquire the greatest bliss and prosperity. It is always self-reform for Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He had to begin from within. He explained the rights of the individuals, the rights of society, so that the individuals should help one another by mutual cooperation and endeavor for the prosperity of the society and the benefit for all people if they collectively work together. This is exactly how he tried to achieve poverty, and this is the only way you can achieve it, is when you and I cooperate together to help one another. As long as I'm only thinking of myself, thinking of my wealth, collecting from myself, I'm going to be poor. Now, it says that Elon Musk, 3% of his wealth will eradicate world hunger. One man only. 3% of his wealth, not all of it, would eradicate hunger itself. Do we see them doing it? Of course not. Let us take a break and then we come back right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Man himself is composed of three things. Obviously, a body, a spirit, and sentiments, if we can say the least. Body is a material part of man. It also enjoys right, which must be respected. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, whose efforts were centered on the enforcement of the self and good morals, also endeavored to lay the foundation of society on equity and justice, and to enact justice law for the material and worldly life of man. He tried to create that balance, that yes, we do understand that you have a body, and the body is material in its nature, and it requires material matter. But should we let it loose? Should I let myself indulge in anything I desire? If I desire wealth, should I go and get as greedy as I can, even if it means many people will get, you know, hurt in the process, as we see in Africa, for example, the blood diamond? Or no? Or should I, you know, control myself? If I say, no, I need to control myself, where do I begin? And this is exactly where Amir al-Mu'mineen tapped on. The spiritual aspect of man that needs, if that is cultivated, if that's being taught correctly, it should put a leash on the desire of oneself. So he created this kind of reformation from within. It was also the object of Imam Ali alayhi salam to guide people to the purity of heart and the acquisition of good conduct, and to nurture and train the conscience in such a way that they might shun bad habits of their own accord without being forced, and adorn themselves with good qualities. This was the, you know, as simple as we could make it, was the mission of Amir al-Mu'mineen. To make sure that I get rid of all vices and replace them with virtues. If I have these virtues, then I would learn not to harm another human being. I learn to cooperate with other people. I learn to help other people and feed them and give them from what I have. I share with them. This act itself, it should and it will eradicate poverty if we collectively work towards this aim. If we collectively have this idea, this mentality in our mind, the mentality that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi tried so hard to achieve. However, it is not possible to develop good habits until one has food to eat and dress to wear, and the people cannot acquire means of livelihood until justice is prevailed, which is another issue that we will face in trying to seek virtues. If I'm hungry, good luck to my virtues. Let us continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.